This is Turn One Thoughtsies. I'm Aaron.
And I'm Zach.
And this is episode 79, Kite Sail Freebooting for Fun and Profit. This week we are talking about humans. Obviously they are the biggest top of the heap right now. So we're going to cover kind of how do you beat them? How do you play them to a certain extent? More beat them, even though playing them is kind of one way to beat them. We have an announcement about some preview cards that we were given and neat decks. And then there was an extended discussion on Twitter about whether or not Thoughtseize is a counterspell, is effectively a counterspell. And I just sort of put it up on a lark as a spinoff of a discussion that I was having somewhere else. And it got quite a few responses, which I was surprised by, and very contentious. Like, people had good points on both sides. We're going to talk about that kind of as a continuation of the resource denial sort of mini series that started last time with land destruction. So this time we're going to sort of cover discard and how to think about it. So let us get started.
Oh, don't forget the Karn previews, or not previews, but Karn lessons, I guess.
Yes. Well, and we will also, Zach has been playing extensively with new Karn, the $70 standard all-star, multi-format all-star. It hasn't quite reached its peak in modern yet, but obviously all over standard, all over legacy, all over vintage, for what that counts for, it is there. So, yes. So let's get started. First of all, Patreon shout outs. Thank you to all of our patrons. Thank you especially to our newest Cabal Interrogators, Jamar, John, and Eric. If you are interested in learning more about the Patreon, you can check it out at patreon.com/turn1thoughtsies, all spelled out. We have not one, but two Battle Bond preview cards coming on May 23rd. Apparently we did a good enough job with Torgar that we're in the queue. We're in the hopper.
I don't know if that sounds... I'm not sure that sounds like a good place to be, but I'm happy we're there.
It's... I guess...
We're in the hopper.
We're waiting to get shot out of the... All right, so I see... all right, I hear it now. We're in the field.
How about we're on the list?
We're on the list. There we go.
That sounds privileged.
I'm like, yeah, because where I was going to turn into like a slaughterhouse metaphor, yeah, and I was just like, no, that doesn't work either. No, that's not it. Anyways, so we're on the list. You should tweet at Blake PR. Blake Rasmussen is the PR guy who is in charge of handing out the preview cards, and tell him how much you love us and help us to keep getting previews. Battle Bond, for anybody who does not know yet, is one of the draft, they call them draft innovation sets. So it's like Conspiracy, Take the Crown, Unstable. And so Battle Bond is specifically designed for Two-Headed Giant, which is really interesting.
Yeah, if you've never played Two-Headed Giant is an incredibly fun format. It sounds like it wouldn't be that much fun, right, if you haven't played it before, and it seems like it's kind of dirtily and long, but as a change of pace format to play with one of your friends, you know, like after a more serious thing you do, it is awesome. I've had some of my favorite memories from pre-releases and Two-Headed Giant events, and I am very excited to play this. It's probably not the type of event I would play, you know, more than two or three times, unless the format's like actually very good. But oh my gosh, am I excited to play that first time. I've already got two friends and, you know, whoever else we can find lined up to just go to the store the night it comes out, and we're going to do one.
Yeah, I did a Two-Headed Iconic Masters PAX East last year.
Okay.
And it was the first time I'd even done Two-Headed Giant, and it was fun. It was a very interesting difference, because you have another person there, yeah, and they're on your team. Like, it's not like, regular multiplayer where you're trying to like get the other people.
Yep.
So they're not clearly not helping you.
Well, and it's different from like Team Magic, where it's like, you know, you guys are on a team, but you're not at all involved in each other's games. You're just kind of talking to each other. Whereas like you guys are actually playing the same game and interacting and like helping each other. It's very cool.
Yep. There is an entirely new plane that it takes place on, which has a lot of interesting implications. So Conspiracy took place on the plane of Fiora. Unstable took place on Bablovia. And Battlebond takes place on a place called Kylem, a never-before-seen plane where beings flock from all over to the arena of Valor's Reach, where two-on-two combat is the pinnacle of sport. That is from the press release, so I didn't just make that up off the top of my head. And the flavor is sports and games, right? Like if Theros is Greek mythology and Innistrad is Victorian horror, this is sports and games. So it should be really interesting. I like these sort of these sets because there's no pressure on them to specifically include anything, but it gives them the opportunity to include things. So like stuff that I would love to see, like there's always reprints in these sets, right? And so these are great opportunities to put like land cycles are just like super easy because they're great and limited.
Yep. It's a really good spot to get some like expensive uncommons that just for whatever reason, you know, just like creep up in value over time.
Yep. And hey, you know, for Legacy people, I stand behind Kaya Ghost Assassin as a tremendous planeswalker in Legacy, even though I don't think outside of me playing her in like black white control and maybe some people playing her in Maverick, I don't think she sees a ton of play, but
I played against Kaya Ghost Assassin in a Legacy event. Jeff Hoogland was playing Kaya.
Yeah.
We played against him in a team event where he was playing Kaya. Seriously, like he was actually playing the card and it was good.
It's amazing. Like I draw, you discard is like it was the thing that I used to use to beat Miracles, but it's good against like any of the Brainstorm like Jace decks.
Yeah.
Which, if we're being honest, is like a third of the decks.
It's a decent portion.
So yeah, Legacy's in a weird spot right now. Just I don't know what the solution is. And I don't know if the solution is like what everybody thinks it is, which is ban Deathrite Shaman. Because I don't think that does enough to like actually change the format.
Like, I don't want to get into Legacy. We're talking about Battle Bond. I don't think anything needs to be done. I think it just is what it is, and it's a fine format.
There you go. But
Battle Bond, they said on the press release there's going to be Legacy cards in it. So I would expect that we might get some new, you know, Kaya or Leovold-esque type cards. So that could be cool. Yeah. Unfortunately, we don't get those for Modern yet. You know, fingers crossed that happens eventually where they start kind of printing cards specifically for Modern. But, you know, until then, we'll just have to deal with or make do with reprints. And I mean, if you go look at just like prices of, you know, some cards that aren't super played, but are just like, you know, the decks use and are just old at this point, they just haven't been reprinted yet. Like, this is an awesome place to bring down the cost of just like some random staples that you know, decks just need. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, look at the, you know, like reprinting Silvereal Adept, reprinting, you know, like just
recent ones where have been awesome, have been very good for Modern, right?
Yeah. Cause there's a lot of these decks. Oh, you know what my dream would be is if they reprinted like a lot of the Tree Folk. I know that sounds stupid, but you wouldn't think that like tier 3
Lorwyn,
tribal deck.
Lorwyn is a very expensive just
oh my
set,
God,
dude. It's very expensive.
Every single card. It's like the way that Merfolk used to be, where like the cards individually are not expensive, but there aren't any cheap cards. So like every card costs $3 or $4.
Yeah, that whole like little block, Lorwyn, Shadowmoor, Eventide, Morningtide, all of them, very expensive right now.
But yeah, so I would love to see Tree Folk. That would honestly make me really happy because I enjoy playing Tree Folk as just like a fun tribal deck. And I play it on Magic Online because the cards are dirt cheap on Magic. Like on MTGO, I think the entire Tree Folk deck that I have cost $2 maybe.
It's fair. And yeah, in real life, probably like 100.
In paper, it's like 400.
Oh, Jesus. It's so much.
Yeah. Well, because every, like I said, every card is $4 to $5.
That's fair.
Even like the one drop, the Banneret, is actually I haven't looked at it recently to cry. Oh no, what is it? Treefolk Harbinger. $2. It's a $2.03 for one that searches for a treefolk and puts it on top of your library. And then like Dauntless Dourbark is another one that's like a very important part of the deck. $5 each.
It's fair.
So you need four of those. And then like the Bosk Banneret is cheap because I think it did get a reprint. Anyways, bottom line is treefolk are great, but they're very expensive. I would love to see them reprinted in this set. I do not know if that's going to happen, but boy, that would be great.
And I know some tier one modern decks are looking for some uncommons and or commons to be reprinted, and they got their fingers crossed they're in there.
Yes.
Specifically, right. maybe like the Hollow One deck could be hoping to get some cards, but we'll see.
If Goblin Lore is in this set, I mean, I guess it could be, right? Like,
very unlikely that it would be. Because this set was probably designed before that took off.
Sure, but I mean,
there is a non-zero chance the card is in the set, but like I would expect, like if that card was getting a reprint, I would expect it to be reprinted in like next year's set of whatever this is, you know, or like a master set or something. It's just it's so expensive and it's so obscure and it like just became popular.
Yeah, but it's one of those things, right? Like if you're pulling all of these different races from like different planes, like there has to be a team.
Well, the problem with the card is that it's just not a good card. Like, there's no reason to play it outside of, like, the exact use it's used for in Modern. So it's like, there's no reason to include it in a different set outside of, like, just giving it a reprint.
Sure.
So I don't expect it to be in there, but it would be cool if it was.
They reprinted one Leyline in a set, right? Like, that was functionally pointless.
Well, but that is the idea, though, right? Is, like, they slip in some number of these cards every single set. It's because they can only put so many cards that do nothing in it. And it's right. Like, they usually only do it for the very expensive ones, but like, this card wasn't expensive when they were designing the set. It was a $0 uncommon because nobody played it.
Sure.
You know?
All right. Enough wild speculation. Our actual announcement will be on 5/23. It'll be on Twitter. It'll be, we'll do some kind of episode about it, or about both of them. And see, because there's two of us and it's Two-Headed Giant, so we got two previews.
Yes.
See how that works?
Very clever.
Clever. we did see also some sick decks this week.
Yeah, man. I don't know where this came from, but all of a sudden we've been getting some just like user submitted decks on Twitter and it's awesome.
Yeah.
Huge fan.
So after the last episode, you talked briefly, or during the last episode, you talked briefly about a blue white heroic deck.
Historic.
That, what's that?
Blue white historic.
Yeah. Didn't I say that?
You said heroic, which is.
Oh, heroic. Different. Okay. I'm sorry. Blue-white historic deck that you played against in Magic Online, and one of our faithful listeners and also Magic flavor text writer
and noted author
A.E. Marling came back to us and was just like, hey, I made this blue-white historic deck and it looks really cool.
Dude, like, it's awesome. This deck you put together is sweet.
I mean, highlights, obviously, Raph Capuchin, I think, is one of the reasons to play the deck, right?
Like, yep.
Play your entire deck with Flash seems strong, and you can power him out on turn two. If you have, like, turn one Undaidaki tapped Mox Amber, and then there's Isamaru's in here. So then, like...
Pretty hard to get him out on turn two, but like...
Oh, yeah, that's true, because there's two colors. All right, that's a lie.
But you can play three drops on turn two, which is, like, ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, very easily.
Yeah, Big Thalia, Kira, obviously the Grand Arbiter that we talked about. So, like, there's just a lot going on here. Good, like, utility lands, obviously. Undaidaki, you talk... Iganjo Castle is insane in this deck.
Yeah.
Iganjo Castle is the... it's legendary land, comes into play untapped, taps for white, and it has white tap, prevent the next two damage that would be dealt to target legendary creature this turn. So basically save your whatever from a lightning bolt, usually.
Well, like, the only card that's ever seen play with in Modern is Thalia, and it never saved that from Lightning Bolt, which is always just, like, really disappointing, so it never saw play. But when you're playing, like, legends that have more than one toughness, that card is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a Kira in this deck. Can you, like, it's so frustrating to deal with a Kira when you have an Iganjo Castle. It's so awesome.
Yeah. So, and then a big, big, fatty, right, like, Dragonlord Ojutai. How do you make Dragonlord Ojutai better? Give it Flash.
Or cast it on turn three.
Or cast it on turn three. Like, any of those things. Urza's Ruinous Blast as, like, an amazing board wipe. Like, five mana.
It's literally all is dust, but for this deck, which is insane. Yes. It's so busted.
Yep. And Mox Amber, obviously. Flagstones. Like, Flagstones just good. Path, Remand, Repeal, Settle Wreckage, Patrician Scorn, a classic Spice Rack entry. Future Sight, 3 and a white, instant. If you played another white spell this turn, you may play Patrician Scorn without paying its mana cost. Destroy all enchantments. Strong. Oh, that's in the maybe board. Yeah. And then Jace the Mind Sculptor, Teferi, new Teferi, Hero of Dominaria.
I mean, we don't need to go through the rest of the cards, but the thing is that it's just like, it's a bunch of cards you would already play in Modern, and it's just like very powered up with like some other cards that make the strategy very good. Like this looks to me like this is like a tier 2 Modern deck waiting to be tuned to tier 1, and it's just like nobody's played with it yet. But there is something here, I promise.
A lot of juice in that deck. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And last week on stream, I also I played a sweet deck, which was with the fine folks from Brew City MTG. You can follow their Twitch is twitch.tv/brew_city_MTG. We played Beck and Call Goblins, which was surprisingly good. This was a largely untested list, but it basically, you use Beck and Call, which is the it's like Glimpse of Nature. Whenever a creature comes into play this turn, you draw a card. And so you're playing like all the good goblins, all of the 2-mana token producers, and Goblin Electromancer. So what you end up with is like Fecundity. If Fecundity is in play, you can pretty much go off. If you don't have Fecundity in play, you can play Beck and Call, which will usually, in conjunction with Goblin Electromancer and like Dragon Fodder or whatever, get you to the point where you're drawing enough cards to get your Fecundity out or get like the other combo piece that you need. And then once you have like Skirk Prospector, you can just go off. And then if you've got Beck and Call and then you go Empty the Warrens for 5, you draw 10 cards. And then you sack those goblins to power out whatever you drew. Like, we went 3-2 in the league, and one of the matches that we lost was because somebody, I mean, quote unquote hard cast, like they cast at an Emrakul, the Promised End, during the Mindslaver turn, milled us out by drawing 14 cards off of a Beck and Call Empty the Warrens.
That's awesome. That's such a good way to lose a game of Magic. That's so cool.
Like, I was upset, right? Because I was like, oh, I didn't want to lose that game. But also, like, we lost the game because the deck works so well.
You can't be that upset. Like, losing the Emrakul decking you from drawing too many cards is just kind of sweet.
Yeah. So the I think that version of it, it could have very easily been a 4-1. And if one or two of the individual games had broken a different way, it could have very easily been a 5-0. So the 3-2 test, right? Like that's the baseline. To be a viable Modern deck, you have to be able to 3-2 a league. And if you can do that, then you're probably onto something. And from there, it's just like tuning and practice and all that stuff.
Sure.
So I was really pleased. I'll put the list up. Adam is the same guy that did the Tayshar deck that we talked about in the last episode.
Yep.
So that is that, let's grab some beck and calls, man. They're like 40 cents. I mean, that's, they're nothing. Cause there used to be an old beck and call elves list.
Well, it used to be a lot better when you could cast the fused spell.
Right. And then the fuse
in the jar or whatever. Then it was like, yes, actually spiking, but whatever.
Yeah. Well, it's back down to an extraordinarily reasonable price.
It's fair. But anyway, let's get to what the people actually came here for.
Humans. They are everywhere. Turns out that, like, the most common creature type in the entire game at some point reaches a critical mass where there's so many spell-like effects attached to them that you can just play a deck that's all humans.
Well, yeah, I mean, humans always had that, like, it's had that critical mass for a while. The problem for it was always that it was just spread out to too many colors. It was they needed the critical mass of lands, and they finally got it, so.
Yes. Unclaimed Territory definitely contributed to being able to, like, play the deck, but I think you could have still made the five-color mana base, because, like, that's a thing. It's better this way. I think the thing that really pushed it over the edge is Kitesail Freebooter.
Well,
that is my surmise.
You're not wrong. I mean, that is 100% part of what did it. And, you know, we're going to make a strange comparison with the card later in the episode, but that card is a lot stronger than it looks on paper.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, humans has very quickly become the Jund deck of modern format, which is strange to say because Jund still exists in modern and is still popular in modern, but Jund is just doing what Jund wants to do worse than humans is doing it. And, you know, Jund's strategy forever has been, you know, people always get Jund kind of confused about what it actually is doing, but it kind of has always been just disrupt your opponent enough that one of your insane threats will kill them. And that's kind of what it did forever. It was just like, I'm just going to, you know, disrupt things that kind of matter a little bit, and then, you know, Bob or Tarmogoyf or Liliana the Veil or whatever, you know, card we're using at this period of time is going to beat you. And humans just does that better. It just has disruption, you know, has a little bit less disruption, but a lot more threats, and it just ends the game quicker, which is exactly what, you know, discard decks want, so.
Yeah, Mantis Rider is a hell of a magic card, it turns out, as, like, a 5/5.
Yeah, I mean, like, the real house is Thalia's Lieutenant, right? Thalia's Lieutenant is insane in that deck.
God, freaking card. Yep. Yeah, it's nuts.
Yeah.
It's a very frustrating card to play against.
No, for sure. But yeah, so humans is everywhere. In fact, the most recent modern Mox event, the Magic Online Championship Series, was a mirror match between humans in the finals, which is no surprise because, you know, humans kind of beats everything, and it just turns out that the deck is capable of, it just is capable of adapting to the metagame. There just is enough ETB effects on creatures that, you know, cost a small amount of mana that you can kind of adapt, and it's like, there isn't a human for everything, but the deck is playing, like, Reclamation Sage, and that kind of makes up the need to destroy an enchantment on a creature, which humans didn't have. It's a card, Phantasmal Image, which is almost like Snapcaster Mage in a deck where you're just caring about ETBs on bodies, and it's just incredible in that deck. So, I don't know. I think this deck's really, really strong.
It's definitely here to stay. It's difficult to hate out in the sense that the key interaction, as far as I'm concerned, and the thing that gives the deck a lot of its play is that you can Kitesail Freebooter to get information about what's in your opponent's hand, and then you Meddling Mage to name whatever the thing is that's in their hand that's going to kill you.
Well, and Freebooter takes a card. So, like, just an example of this, I was just playing humans the other day on Magic Online. Like, I was testing the deck. I was just, you know, maybe I want to play at the next event. We'll see how it goes. I'm playing against Burn. I mulled a 5, which is horrible for me. But my hand has a land, an Aether Vial, a Freebooter, and a Meddling Mage. And I'm like, you know, playing against Burn, this probably isn't going to go well, but maybe. I'm on the play because I lost game 1, so I, like, get my Vial up to 2. And then on my turn 3, I Freeboot him. I see his hand is, like, 2 lands, like a Skullcrack, and he had 2 Boros Charms. Or it was a Searing Blaze, and he had 2 Boros Charms. So I get to Freeboot away the Searing Blaze, and then I play Meddling Mage and name Boros Charm, and then I won the game very easily. And it's like, if I had 2, you know, like a Thought Season Inquisition there, I would have been in a much worse scenario. Like, I don't have a body in play. I didn't get to take two cards effectively. And yeah, I mean, it was a big deal.
Yeah. So that's, that is the thing that I think really propels the deck, because those Nevermore effects are usually not good enough, because one, they usually cost three mana, and two, like three mana or more, and two, it, pairing them with some kind of like information, now that there's no Gitaxian Probe, right? Like, we have to, you have to pay some cost to see your opponent's hand.
Yep.
And it's not free.
No, but if you're already doing it and with other effects, it is good enough.
Yes. Well, it's definitely good enough at two mana. And the fact that it doesn't get hit by Torpor Orb is one, mind boggling, and two, is something that I don't know. Like, it's one of those unintended interactions, because Torpor Orb is very good against the deck as a general statement. Against that specific card, against Meddling Mage, it doesn't work at all, because the Meddling Mage ability is not an ETB. It's an as you cast. So Torpor Orb doesn't do anything. The only thing, if you had a Torpor Orb in play and a Meddling Mage came down, it wouldn't trigger like Athalia's Lieutenant.
Yeah, which is fine. I mean, it stops a lot of power from being on the board.
It's right. It's something. And it's still definitely worth playing, but you also need to consider that if you are a couple of turns into the game and your opponent has a good idea of what you are playing, then you can still get Meddling Maged through your hate. And, you know, sometimes it's exactly what you said, right? You've got two Boros Charms and they basically like Cabal Therapy you on a body, and there's nothing you can do about it. And then you just get beat down by a bunch of 2/2s.
Yeah. And that is kind of exactly what makes humans good, is it has the Thought Seize thing, which is also, or the Thought Seize against hate, which is also what made Death Shadow pretty good for a while, was you can bring all these hate cards to hate them, but they might just take them out of your hand and you might never get to use them. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of what's making the deck good. But we said a little bit earlier that humans is like the Jund deck of the format, right? Where it is kind of taken Jund's place, and it plays in a very similar manner to Jund. But if you look historically, Jund has always been good in Modern, but it's always been beatable. And if you, I guess, except at the time of Deathrite Shaman, but besides that period of time, Jund has always been very beatable, and there are certain strategies that exploit Jund very well. And if we want to beat humans, we can kind of look at the past and see, well, you know what, beat Jund. And as it turns out, going way over the top of Jund was generally a good way to beat it. Now, that's difficult for humans, because humans is so much lower to the ground that it's harder to get over the top of them without dying. But it is certainly doable with sweepers, where one of humans' bad matchups is actually Tron. I mean, it's winnable. You can beat Tron with humans, and it's, you know, kind of 50-50. But Tron does a pretty good job of getting over the top of them, kind of sweeping the board repeatedly. And then
you need to be able to stick O-Stone and then cast it.
Yeah.
Or, and then activate it, rather.
Well, it's just any sweeper. I mean, Ugin's going to do a really good job against humans, I promise.
Oh, sure.
Yes. So, yeah, Tron can get over the top of it. And then Jund has also historically been very bad against decks that just 2-for-1 it repeatedly. Like, if you are just 2-for-1-ing Jund repeatedly, they're going to run out of cards. You won't. And then you're going to win. And humans, actually, as it turns out, is quite weak to that strategy as well. It has very little ability to generate card advantage. In fact, its entire source of card advantage is just kind of working off the idea that it draws the perfect amount of lands every game by using Horizon Canopies. And while that works, it doesn't overcome 2-for-1s particularly well. So, you know, if you are just repeatedly 2-for-1-ing the humans deck, you're going to beat it pretty easily. And, you know, I say 2-for-1s, but that's also a proxy for, like, sticking a Planeswalker or, like, a Phyrexian Arena-style, you know, generate card advantage over time effect, and then just trading 1-for-1 repeatedly with them, which also, as it turns out, is going to beat humans. So it's like, there are a couple decks doing that right now, and they're doing it very well, and all of those decks are very good against humans. Two examples, Jeskai quite good, and Eldrazi Tron's a pretty good one against them right now. People have said previously that Eldrazi Tron was pretty bad. I found it to be not as bad as people are saying. But, you know, Big Tron can go over the top of them. It'll 2-for-1. It'll, like, 8-for-1 them with an Ugin. And then Classic Affinity also happens to be really good against humans just because it has more flyers and it has lifelinking creatures and it's really good at racing and creature mirrors. So yeah, Affinity's another good one.
So one of the things that I think people should also consider, and this is something that we've talked about in terms of fetch lands, weirdly enough, is playing around Pithing Needle type effects by playing a diversity of fetch lands so that, like, in the case where somebody has, like, I think we talked about it mainly, like, when Lantern was sort of, like, having its big thing where they were able to run, they're running Pithing Needles in the main, and so if you were just running all of one fetch, there were certainly times where they could just be like, oh, Pithing Needle, Flooded Strand, and then you've three dead cards in your hand and you can't cast any of your spells. So the way to sort of get around that is you play Flooded Strand and Windswept Heath. And then if one shut off, the other one probably isn't. They probably don't have a second Pithing Needle to like name your other fetch land. If they do, you're going to lose anyways, but at least you're not completely locked out. I think that people need to think about adding some diversity of answers to their main deck. Like to the extent that it's reasonable, right? Like a lot of modern decks are four of. And the humans deck is able to leverage that very easily, right?
Yeah.
Bam. Freeboot your thing, figure out what you're going to cast, and then shut it off with Meddling Mage.
Yep.
So, you know, you can do that if you're running four lightning bolts, that's great. Maybe you need to run three lightning bolts and a flame slash. So they can name lightning bolt, but the flame slash will still kill the meddling mage unless things have gotten very out of hand with Thalia's lieutenant, which they may have. If that happens, like once again, you're already kind of in a rough position, but if you can get over that hump to then unlock the rest of the cards in your hand or the cards that you're likely to draw, then you can sort of come back to them and say, okay, flame slash your meddling mage, bolt your freebooter, get back my other bolt, you know, start taking out your threats, then execute your game plan, whatever that game plan happens to be.
No, I mean, you're totally right on that. And to be honest, like we've said this in past episodes, but people just aren't listening. Like it's happening in modern still where they just like are still running four of and they're still getting beat by meddling mage. So it's like, do it. Like, switch up the cards that you can switch. Like, I don't know that you always want to switch Lightning Bolt. Like, some cards are just so good, you're just not going to switch that one specifically, but...
Sure.
Like, there are 100, like, other cards for sure that, like, why aren't you switching them? Like, I know, for instance, I was talking to Ari Lax about playing Jeskai this weekend, and, you know, I sent him a list, and it had two Supreme Verdicts in it, and I was like, you know, I think, you know, Supreme Verdict's a really good call this weekend, and he goes, why aren't you playing a Supreme Verdict in a Wrath of God? And I was like... I don't know. Good call. We've been talking about this on my podcast, and I should take my own advice, right? Yeah, so, no, I mean, that's 100% it. Like, you should definitely, you know, diversify your stuff. And it really is built, humans, like, disruption plan really is built like a house of cards, kind of the way you explained, where it's like, you pull out that one piece, and then kind of, like, their whole kind of disruption plan falls apart. And it generally just starts with killing a meddling mage, so
yeah, I mean,
make sure you can kill that guy.
Right. And it's also, I mean, hey, and there's 100 ways to do it. You know, if you have somehow magically have a good matchup against everything except humans, you can straight up just run human frailty in the sideboard, right? and that'll be your thing. You can generate black mana. You can cast human frailty. It's a one mana instant that kills a human.
Yep.
Boom. So
get him.
Thank you, Avacyn Restored, I think.
Sure. But yeah, so the other deck, like I said, I was talking about Jeskai, and Jeskai is popping up a ton right now on Magic Online. If you're playing in the modern queues, you're probably playing against Jeskai. Teferi gave that deck a huge shot in the arm. I played it at the Team SCG 2 weeks ago. It was really good. Teferi has legitimately made this deck very good. That card is insane in the deck.
All right, I have a question about that.
Sure.
Is Jeskai good or is Teferi good? And is there a better shell that he could be in?
No, I think Jeskai legitimately is just the best shell for Teferi. It just does exactly what Teferi wants, and it does it better than Blue-White did, which is Teferi is just this weird, like, Delver-esque card where you kind of have this game plan of, I'm just going to trade and keep this thing alive, and then when it gets to 8, the game's over. And it gets to 8 very quickly. And you never feel, like, there's a lot of Planeswalkers where it feels like you're taking off a turn. You know, you like you put your Jace Mind Sculptor in play, and you maybe, you know, brainstorm or bounce something or whatever, and you just kind of cross your fingers and hope to untap while you can't do anything for the next turn. But Teferi just, like, untaps the land, so it's like you're never tapped out. You can always defend it. And the second you get to 8 and you get that emblem, like, the game is over. Modern decks are not equipped to beat that emblem, and they don't. They do not beat that emblem. So it's like, you just play your Teferi, you stick it, you start plussing. You know, it looks like you're going to minus, looks like minusing is a good idea. You don't minus, you never minus. You start plussing, and you plus until you get to 8, and you make an emblem, and then the game ends. Just, it's not beatable. It's so outrageous in Modern. So, you know, Jeskai trades very well and very, very mana efficiently, which blue-white kind of had trouble with. Blue-white can kind of get caught with its, you know, for lack of a better term, with its pants around its ankles while it's, like, sitting with two Wraths and some 4-mana counterspells and 6-mana Planeswalkers in its hand, kind of doing nothing and losing to aggro draws. And Jeskai never really had a problem with that. Jeskai kind of had a problem with its 1-mana removal not matching up right and just kind of just not having the right answers at the right time, but it never really got tempoed out, generally. And Teferi just kind of fixed all of that because it's like, well, now you just get to draw more removal, more and more. They have to overcome this extra, like, extra heaping of removal in time to beat Teferi, which they just, you know, generally don't do, and then they lose to Teferi. So, yeah. The card's really strong, and it gets people.
Yes. Speaking of cards that get people, let's talk Karn. You have a piece.
Yes. Well, I was going to say, another subset of strategies that are coming out to be human are just colorless decks. You know, humans is kind of got the top dog thing going on right now where it needs to kind of fight everything from a bunch of different angles because there's a bunch of different decks trying to attack it. And I think colorless decks are particularly well set up to beat it right now. And that's, you know, like Affinity, Tron, Eldrazi, Tron, all of those. And mostly from a shot in the arm in Karn. And Karn is, I think, you know, if you're following Magic at all, you've been seeing it in Standard. It's kind of dominating Standard. It's even recently started to dominate Legacy to an extent. It's a very, very powerful card, but it's confusing and it's definitely difficult to use. So it really is skill testing, but it's an incredibly powerful Planeswalker. I think, honestly, it's, you know, a top 5 Planeswalker in Modern. I don't think it's a stretch to call it that at this point yet. And I think it'll just prove to be stronger. But the real thing holding it back is people just aren't entirely sure how to play with it at this point. So I'm going to kind of give you the 3 modes of Karn to get you prepared and able to beat the card. So Karn's first play pattern is aggro Karn. Now, this is the one you're going to see mostly in Affinity, although it can kind of be in any deck that's playing Karn. Obviously, all these modes could be in any of the Karn decks, but this is the one most common to Affinity, where it's just, you play Karn, you minus two, just on back-to-back turns, and his minus two makes an XX construct, where X is the number of artifacts you control, and the construct is also an artifact, so it's always a 1-1, and then for each artifact, it gets +1/+1. And that's just, like, obviously that sounds good, but it doesn't, it's not, you can't understand how good it is until you, like, actually play against it, where the modern decks playing this card for this effect are set up so that minus 2 is, like, a 6-6 or a 7-7 or an 8-8, and then the second one turns both of them into, like, 8-8s or 9-9s. It just gets outrageous so quickly, and it's so hard to keep up with, and if you don't kill, like, even if you kill both those tokens, you still haven't dealt with Karn, which is, you know, kind of the issue with the card, so aggro Karn.
Then you shift gears and you start drawing cards.
Yeah, and honestly, in aggro Karn situations where you're just -2/-2, it seems like you're gonna mine it. Like you're gonna, oh, I'm gonna do my second -2. It's gonna be left over with 1 loyalty. I'm gonna go my next turn. We get to start plussing and draw cards. But to be quite honest, you don't usually get to draw that card because you probably killed them already. Usually, that second Karn is, or the second -2 is just enough to get that last bit of damage in. So aggro Karn is really strong. I think it's the mode you're going to see the most of in Modern, but it is, obviously it's not the only mode Karn uses. So, mode 2, we have the value Karn, and value Karn is, kind of the one people, think of when they look at Karn. They think that this is kind of what the card's about, but there are different ways to go about it, and it's, you have to do it very specifically. So, for the value Karn, the true value Karn, you need generally 3 to 4 copies of card in your deck. You want multiple copies of this card in your deck so you can draw extra copies of it. And the first card you play it, and all you do is +1. You don't -1, you don't -2. You just keep +1-ing it until it dies. And generally what that's going to do is it's going to, every time it +1s, it reveals 2 cards. Your opponent puts one of them in your hand, and the other one gets exiled with a silver counter. And what's going to happen is you're going to like flip a land and a good card, and your opponent's going to give you the land, and the good card's going to get exiled. Then you keep plussing Karn, and you just keep drawing lands and hitting your land drops. And meanwhile, you're kind of slowing your opponent down. They're forced to deal with Karn, or this card is just going to generate so many resources you win. And eventually they do deal with Karn. Karn dies. But by that time, you've probably drawn a second Karn, or even a third Karn, right? And then every Karn you play after that, you play it and immediately -1. And then it's like you almost get a demonic 2 to your library. You get to pick between, you know, 5 or 6 cards that are exiled that are, you know, generally all very good cards because your opponent chose a worse card to give you between those cards. And you've hit a bunch of land drops because you were getting lands from Karn plussing before. So it's like you play a card, -1, draw the exact card you need for the scenario, and then get to cast that card in the same turn. So it's like this insane Flame Tongue Kavu-esque situation. It's really good.
That's like the, you're making a Karn deck. Like, you're not adding Karn to an existing deck. You're like, I'm going to make a deck that has 4 Karns, and Karn is going to be the centerpiece.
Well, kind of, but, like, it doesn't need to do that. That's just, like, if you want a value engine and you didn't have a value engine before, Karn is that value engine. Like, if you didn't have access to a better value engine than this, Karn becomes that engine. Now, you need to be able to stay alive. Like, this is a slower strategy, but if your deck can stay alive and you wanted a value engine, Karn is very good at that. This is specifically in like Eldrazi Tron and Normal Tron that I see this strategy happening, but it's like, those are two decks where it's like the +1 can be so devastating, or the +1, like their choices can be so devastating. And it's like giving Tron decks a land is generally horrible for you. You don't want to do that, but also giving them like Ugin or Karn, like 7 mana Karn, is also horrible for you. So it's like you put him in this really bad spot. And you know, he doesn't really, Karn, like, Formula Karn doesn't really get hit with any of the hate cards. It's just, yeah, it's very easy to use the value Karn. And you don't have to build your deck around it. You just kind of have to put him in there if you want some value.
Well, and, I mean, thank God there's a rule that says you can only have one of one type of Planeswalker in play. So you can't have 4 mana Karn and 7. Ooh, but there isn't anymore. So now you can have 4 mana Karn and 7 mana Karn. So you can be plussing 4 mana Karn to draw 2 cards every turn, even if like one of them is a suboptimal card, and then also using the other one to like blow up your opponent's resources. That seems strong. I feel like that's a winning line.
Look, let me tell you, I had that happen this Tuesday. I had both of them in play, and I don't think you've really lived in Modern until you've experienced this.
Whoa.
It is a lot of fun. Now, you probably don't, I mean, the 4 mana Karn's kind of just, you know, whatever, like, you have a 7 mana card in play, you should be winning, but it's still awesome, it's totally fun, you just activate all these colorless planeswalkers, it's sweet. If you get the Ugin too, you've lived the trifecta, that's the entire dream.
Sure. Well, until they make the next Ugin.
Oh man, can we get a 4 mana Ugin too? That'd be awesome. Or maybe like a 5 mana Ugin, just so we can go 4, 5, 6, 7.
No, they should have...
Oh, 7, 8, 7, 8, sorry.
They should have banned Karn Liberated and made Ugin 7 mana. So we would. So that's the only one that we would have to deal with on turn 3.
Oh my! Please no. Ugin is way better than Karn. I don't want any of that.
Yes, that is correct. I built or tried to build a number of Tron decks where the idea was like turn 3 Ugin, and it does work sometimes, and it's literally impossible to beat.
All right, I can't tell you how many times someone who have like thought sees me when I'm playing just normal Tron. They're like, okay, well, I'm gonna take the card that I can never beat ever in my entire life. I can't beat this card, and they just pull the Ugin out of your hand. So. But yeah, back to 4 mana Karn. The last mode is what I deemed the win Karndition. And this
well
is
played.
Yeah, right. This is where you just like have one Karn in your deck. And this is the mode you're gonna see the least, where, you know, Affinity was kind of the aggro Karn, you know, Tron variants are kind of the value Karn, and then mode 3 just, this can be literally any deck in Modern can do this, and this is where Karn is the weakest. This is not the mode you want to be using him for, but the card is strong enough that you can certainly do this, and it's not wrong. So, but the idea here is you play him, you either plus or minus, depending on what is going to keep him alive better in that scenario, and then you just alternating between plussing one and minusing two. You generally don't minus one in this scenario unless, you know, it's like the absolute perfect card, you need it. But generally, you just want to be plussing one, just generating whatever resource. You don't really care, so you can use minus two more. And you'll see decks do this in standard, but this is not what you want to be doing in modern. Like, they're just, generally you can find a better card for your deck than that, but I don't think it's wrong to do that, and you can certainly do this if you just, you know, you drew one card, maybe this is your game plan, and he's strong enough that he can win games like that, so.
I feel like if you're on the Mega Dirtle plan, like, Teferi's just better.
Well, in the Mega Dirtle plan, yeah, like I said, there's certainly better win cons, like, for specific decks, but again, Karn is powerful enough that, like, this isn't necessarily wrong. And Mode 3 does come up. Mode 3 comes up where it's like, you know, you were resource light. Maybe you're on a mulligan to 5 and, you know, you had, like, 3 lands, a Karn, some creature or something, and your creature died, and now you're just on, like, 4 lands and a Karn. Well, now you're probably on Mode 3 where the new game plan is just keep Karn alive and start using it, and hopefully that wins you the game. And that comes up. I mean, this is Magic. You know, there are different scenarios, so.
Yes. I mean, or like you're playing Elspeth Sun's Champion against me when I'm playing like Assault Loam, and then you tap out for your Elspeth Sun's Champion and I Kozilek's Return your tokens away and then untap and cast Bloodbraid Elf into Tireless Tracker and kill your Elspeth Sun's Champion even though you're at 2 life and then use the Bloodbraid Elf to kill you just to be petty. Because I did that and it was great.
Sure. I don't understand how that's related to Karn, but that sounds sweet.
Well, it's just as a win condition, right?
Fair.
Like a big flashy planeswalker win condition. Like Elspeth Sun's Champion is probably one of the better ones, like one of the better top end payoffs for planeswalkers.
Oh, absolutely.
So
yeah, no, it is.
That's all. Plus, I just wanted to tell that story.
Well, it was sweet. It's a sweet way to win. But anyway, we had a debate about Thoughtseize and counterspells earlier in the week.
Yeah, we kind of did. Like I said, when at the top of the show, I sort of put it out there and I was expecting like not necessarily like a ridiculous ton of responses, but it was a very lively discussion. And for those curious, it ended up being a very narrow 46% said, oh, so the question was, in Modern, is Thoughtseize effectively a counterspell? And explain your position in a reply if you desire. 46% of people said yes, 45% of people said no, 9% just wanted to see the results. Which, when I dug into it a little bit, there were a number of people that actually voted no, but they voted no because they thought it was better than a counterspell. So I sort of count that as a yes.
So essentially people thought that it was a counterspell.
Yeah,
thought that it's a small majority.
An exceedingly small majority.
Well, I mean, if you take some of the no and put in the yes, then
sure.
Some abstract majority.
Even without yes. Right.
Yeah.
Correct. 46% versus 45%. And it was interesting to see what people said. And one of the interesting points that was brought up was that it basically plays the force of will role in Modern, which I think it does, right? It defines the bounds of what is reasonable to play, because it especially puts a lot of downward pressure on like degenerate combo decks, especially like multi-piece combo decks, where you look at your hand and you're like, okay, I have the perfect 6. And then you're playing against Jund and they just go like, Blooming Marsh, Thoughtseize, take your piece and then kill you. Those decks tend not to excel in Modern over a big enough sample size because the discard is so common. And that happens in other formats through like free counterspells or free-ish counterspells. One of the ideas that this question is predicated on is that counterspells and discard spells both impact a similar resource in the sense that they both take a card, right? So you're always, unless you're playing like a Mind Rot or something like that, specifically like Thoughtseize or an Inquisition or even a Freebooter, but Freebooter also kind of feels like a 1.5 for one.
Oh, Freebooter is a straight 2 for 1, man.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I mean, because like the body isn't great. I mean, it's not like.
But it is. That's what makes it so good is that like the body's not great in some decks, but in other decks, it actually just is great.
So Kiteseal Freebooter is too good. You heard it here first.
Well, no, because like a 1/2 flyer like isn't too good, but a 2/3 flyer that like a 1-mana 2/3 flyer, you would play that in every format. Like if it was just black for a 2/3 flyer, you would definitely play that. And you also are interested in playing Duress. Like people want to play that card, right?
Yes and no.
So getting that all in one card is awesome.
Yes, but it does. I mean, it costs 2 mana, right? It's not
sure, but it's like
it's not a complete.
But it does both things, right? Where it's like you get a body of a relevant type and a Duress all in one card for, I mean, you have to pay, you know, the mana for each, but it's like, it is those two things. That's what makes it a 2 for 1.
There you go. Yeah, I guess you're right. Man, Kitesail Freebooter is good. So a regular discard spell that just trades 1 for 1 is comparable in the sense that you're 1 for 1-ing, you're exchanging 1 for 1 of resource of a card for a card. There are, as we said, Kitesail Freebooter, Cryptic Command, same thing as like Cryptic Command is better than a regular counterspell because it also does something else, right? It's like counterspell and tap your team, draw a card, bounce your thing, whatever. And that is why those particular cards are premier in their category. Right, Cryptic Command, I don't think anybody would argue is anything less than the premier counterspell in Modern.
Yeah, it just is. It's the best counterspell. You know, Thoughtseize forever was the best discard spell, but it's quickly become Kitesail Freebooter because it's the best discard spell that 2 for 1's your opponent. And all of these cards are designed to trade 1 for 1. I mean, you said it. That's what they do. You know, you mana leak something, you're just happy you got your 1 for 1 trade. You Thoughtseize something, you know, you're happy if you took a good card out of their hand. Yep. Obviously they're different, but that is the general design. It's just the 1 for 1 trade.
Yep. In terms of resource denial, I want to just sort of obviously split them apart in the sense that cards in hand and cards on the stack are a different type of resource to attack, but the sort of net effect for a lot of things is going to be similar. Because it means that card never hits the board.
Yes. Which is unique because generally like blue and black are the two colors that can affect resources not on the board, whereas, you know, white, red, and green kind of just are limited to interacting with the board.
So you see, you have a note in here that says neither pulls you ahead, they just exchange resources. But obviously Freebooter, Cryptic Command, those sorts of cards actually do put you ahead. But generally speaking, a discard spell or a single counter spell is going to require other cards to win the game, right? Like you're not just going to, unless your opponent happens to be, right? Like you're on the play, you Thoughtseize your ad nauseum opponent. They happen to have their lightning storm in their hand and you take their lightning storm and they're on Lab Maniac or nothing. Yes, that will happen sometimes. And so it will win you the game, or pretty close.
Yeah, but that's corner case. I think the point is made that these cards aren't designed to win the game. They are designed to trade 1 for 1, and it's like they are vehicles to make the rest of your deck be able to do its thing. And generally, you see them in decks that have slower win conditions, where it's like decks that are very fast and very linear do not use these effects because they don't need them. They're just going to do their thing that wins. And if you want to win in a slower manner, you kind of use these to trade 1 for 1 so that your slower win condition can win.
Right. Except in the incidental value case.
Sure.
So eventually what the discussion, the Twitter discussion sort of came to is the distinction between being proactive and being reactive. And we talk a lot about Modern as a format being proactive, where you really need to be executing a game plan and doing things, even if they are sort of like temporarily reactive, I guess, need to be furthering your game plan. Like you can't just sit there and do nothing. And I think that's something that like people who want to play this like blue-white tap-out control are just missing the point, that is almost impossible to make work, because even other slow win condition decks are still every single turn doing something that gets them closer to winning the game instead of getting them closer to not losing the game. And that's a very important distinction in terms of overall strategy. So you had in here, discard spells are tempo negative. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. Cause one of the things that you want, a one for one kind of effect to do, especially with a counterspell or discard spell, is like the gold standard, right? Is that you get to time walk your opponent.
Well, but that's not what I mean by tempo. Like tempo in the sense, like a lot of people have all these definitions for tempo, but what tempo is mana spent, essentially, like mana, effective mana put into the board or into a spell or whatever. And discard spells are always tempo negative in that sense, because you spent mana to trade one for one and your opponent spent zero mana on that trade. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So it's like you initiated a trade where you spent zero mana, where it's like if you're lightning bolting your opponent's creature, that's generally tempo positive because they generally spent one or more mana on it and then you spent one mana to kill it. So it's like a tempo positive trade there.
Got it. Okay. So we're always, we may be trading up on the card face, but not in the actual expenditure.
Yeah, where it's like, you know, you put more mana into the trade than your opponent. That is tempo negative.
Okay.
For that trade specifically. I mean, your point about time walking your opponent stands. Like, that definitely happens. But that, if you're talking about, like, pure tempo, then that's a different, you know, argument.
Got it. So the time walk thing, though, I do think is important. And it's something that people need to consider, both when they are expecting to be targeted by a discard spell and, you know, when you are choosing the card that you take. It is sometimes correct, and it obviously depends on the deck, if you have a fairly prompt win condition, like if you're playing Jund or Death Shadow or something like that, where you can go, I can close out this game in four turns, then it may not be, the answer may not be Thoughtseize your Karn or your Ugin. It might be Thoughtseize your Expedition map, because all you need to do is stumble them long enough so that you can stick a 9/9 and then kill them.
Yep.
If you know you're going for the long game, then you take whatever the thing is that you can't beat. And that could be Karn, it could be Ugin, if you see a Snapcaster Mage, just take the Snapcaster Mage. Like 99.99% of the time, it's always going to be correct to take the Snapcaster Mage, almost no matter what else is in their hand.
Yeah. Well, a really good example of this scenario recently has been, you know, you Thoughtseize a blue opponent, they have Search for Azkanta in their hand. Are you going to take it? It's like, if you're playing a long game, you certainly want to take Search for Azkanta. But if you're planning to kill him quickly, Search for Azkanta does actual nothing for the first, like, two or three turns it's in play, right? So, you know, you just definitely leave that there, right? So I think that's a really good example of that.
I mean, and, you know, if you're, once again, I think because Jund is certainly the most common deck that's playing, like, Thoughtseizes, I think it's very reasonable in a scenario like that where you see Search for Azkanta and you have, like, a Scavenging Ooze in your hand, you double leave it. You're like, I literally don't care about this card at all, because I have a built-in way. Like, good current Jund decks are playing three Scavenging Ooze in the main, which I think is totally correct, and it's what I did when I played Rock, and it won me so many games. Like, when I played Rock at the GP Vegas last year, I mean, I was just clowning on, like, combo decks. Like, I beat Storm, which is like beating Storm game one as like a Rock deck is not something that you would be able to do without Scavenging Ooze.
Yeah.
Because you don't have any other way of meaningfully, like, interacting with their sort of Passing Flames thing. But when you do have it, it's just easy game, easy life, eat up their graveyard, smash in, kill with Tarmogoyfs, win the game.
Yeah.
The other or one other sort of thing that is different is the amount of information. And a counterspell does give you a certain amount of information, but it requires you to sort of make educated guesses about what else is in their deck and what else is in their hand. And that is a skill. Both things require format knowledge, because if you are unfamiliar, you can Thoughtseize someone and know everything that's in their hand and have no idea what their deck is doing. And the same is true of counterspells, right? If you're playing in somebody and they go Ancient Stirrings and you counter it, depending on what else, like what other information you have that's already in play, you have to then go, okay, what is this person playing? If they're playing, like, they could be playing Lantern, they could be playing regular Tron, they could be playing Eldrazi Tron, they could be playing, you know, something else entirely, but you only have the information of what's in front of you. Having the additional information gives you a leg up versus just a straight, it gives you access, like, having perfect information makes a big difference in sort of how you play, how you plan your play. And I think that's one of the big things that matters. It's why Gitaxian Probe was such like a nonsense card.
No, I mean, you're 100% right. And like, counterspells come with their own variation of getting information, where it's like, you don't have to do anything when you have a counterspell. So you get to wait and have your opponent give you information slowly. Whereas a discard spell is just like, boom, here's all the information right here. Like, what are you going to do? Right. And discard, you know, gives you the disruption. So it's like, all right, well, I see what you have. I'm going to take this because that's what you want to do. And I don't want you to do that or whatever. Whereas counterspells is just always this guessing game. It's like, well, I think he's got this based on how he's playing. It's like, should I counter that? Maybe. I don't know. Sure, we're going to fire this off.
There is something that I talk about with discard spells a lot, which is diminishing returns. That is very much the opposite of a counterspell. Generally speaking, as the game goes on, the spells are going to become more and more impactful, meaning that if you have, like, your logic knot on turn two or turn three is fine, your logic knot, which is like literally just counterspell for whatever their haymaker is amazing.
Yep.
Your turn seven Thoughtseize is very sad.
Especially if you cast other Thoughtseizes before, where it's like, it just doesn't do anything. Right.
Yeah. So that's also something to sort of compare and contrast to understand the different ways that these things interact with like card resources in the abstract, and then the application of, you know, maybe which is right for the deck that you want to play, which is right at the different stages of the game. You know, early on, a discard spell may very well be, you know, perform the same function as a counterspell, in the sense that it removes a critical effect from entering play. Also, things have changed. You know, there are very much, there has been a move towards things that are bigger payoff having cast triggers instead of ETB triggers. And I think the big shift of that was Eldrazi with like Oath and Battle for Zendikar. So Ulamog, like countering an Ulamog kind of feels good, except they also get to exile two of your permanents. Thoughtseizing an Ulamog feels really good.
Yeah, get him out of there.
Oh, woof. Be mindful of that also as you sort of keep an eye on what is happening in the metagame and sort of what cards are being played, because there is certainly something to be said for not getting got by just not understanding exactly how a common card works. Cast triggers will get you, and they will get you.
Yeah, no, definitely. Before I move off this though, can I go back to the tempo spot? I would like to.
Yeah, no, go definitely.
I'd like to kind of make a point about this, because I think this is something that's very misunderstood about how discard spells and counter spells differ, I guess, and why, you know, some of them are better in certain formats and vice versa. So like I said before, the tempo aspect of, you know, discarding counter spells are basically just how much mana each player spends in this one-for-one trade you're making, right? And it's like, a discard spell is inherently tempo negative, but because the discard spells you're playing in Modern are generally going to cost one mana, they generally all do, you know, Thoughtseize Inquisition, whatever, there's a floor to how tempo negative they can be, and there's a ceiling, right? They're always going to be one mana tempo negative. But the bonus they give you in that they only cost one mana, so they're a very cheap play. They let you double spell. They give you perfect information of your opponent's hand, your game plan, and they come out on turn one, so you can stop a lot of the, you know, turn two haymakers that exist in this format. You know, cards like Stony Silence and Rest in Peace against, you know, Dredge or whatever. All these Goryo's Vengeance when they have a Grizzled, like all of them. They come out on the crucial turn in this format, which is why you know, people say that it's the best counterspell in Modern, but counterspells are not inherently tempo negative. Counterspells can be tempo negative. They certainly can be, and they certainly cannot be. And it's like the example you gave earlier, it's like you save your 2-mana counterspell for their 5 or 6-mana play. Well, that's insane. You know, you just, you know, doubled the mana investment. You trade a 1-for-1 or whatever, but you spent, you know, a third as much mana. And it's just, that puts you so far ahead, because it's like, you know, you generally have the same amount of mana as your opponent on each turn, or, you know, without including Tron, you know, that's generally going to be the case. So you got to spend the mana doing something else, which just puts you so far ahead. But unfortunately, in Modern, there are so many 1-mana spells. Those are everywhere in this format. Everybody plays 1-mana spells because there is no punishment to having 1-mana spells in the format. And what that means is that all of the good counterspells cost 2 mana, so they're almost all exactly 1-mana tempo negative. Which is what makes these Thoughtseizes and these Inquisitions so much better, is because they come out a turn sooner. You know, they are more proactive. They're much more proactive. They give you more information, and they're generally the same, you know, tempo, you know, negative positive ratio as most of the counterspells of the format. Which is what, in my opinion, makes, you know, Thoughtseize Inquisition the best counterspells of the format. Now, if you look at a format like Legacy, one of the reasons Force Will is so insane is that it can never be tempo negative, which is honestly what makes the card so powerful, right? Where it's like, you're always getting 2-for-1, that does suck, but the fact that it can never be tempo negative just totally makes it worth it. And obviously you can time it, and there's all sorts of other reasons too, but that is one of the biggest reasons why Force Will is insane, is that it can't be tempo negative by definition. I guess unless you spent 5 mana, but...
yeah, which does happen.
Which happens, but if that happens, you're winning, generally, so whatever.
Right. You're in the dirtle mirror.
Yeah. But when you're discarding a card, Force Will can't be tempo negative because you didn't spend mana. And in fact, if you like look at the format, there are actually decks that try to make it tempo negative just to make it worse. And when they do that to Force Will decks, they generally beat them. Where it's like decks like Mono White, sorry, Death and Taxes, will play like a Thalia, yep, and then your Force Will 2-for-1s you, and it's tempo negative because you had to spend a mana on it or whatever to counter their, yep, like path, their Swords to Plowshares or whatever. So
hey, I mean the red-white prison deck that won the GP.
Yeah, I mean, they play Trinisphere. Like, right, your Force Will cost 3, friend. Good luck.
Yeah. And right, you discard a card and pay 3 mana. Like, that's your entire turn. Yeah.
Plus. And now your counterspell is very tempo negative, right? So, that is a thing. I mean, that is certainly a thing.
But, thankfully, we don't have Chromox or Ancient Tomb. So, we don't have to worry about that. And that is fantastic, by the way. Just so we're 100% clear, playing in formats, like if you just put like Chromox back in Modern, it would be abysmal.
Yep, I agree. But that is kind of the whole debate. I think they do kind of serve as the counterspells of the format, just because what, you know, counterspells generally have going for them is that they're tempo positive. They just don't really have going for them in this format. So yeah, I think they are the best counterspells in the format. I mean, there are matchups where counterspells will be tempo positive constantly. Like if you're playing against Tron and you're negating Karns or Ugin's, like, yeah, that's insane. And that's going to be very good. So, you know, it's better. Can be better than a discard spell there. But like, again, it's just like one matchup. The majority of the format isn't like that. So, yep.
There you go. Is there anything else you want to cover or touch on before we wrap it up?
Do you want to talk about why Mental Misstep should be good for Modern?
Ugh, I really don't.
Okay.
We
that one's always tempo positive.
Mental Misstep is a trash card that should have never been printed. And I feel like we covered that at length.
Well, that's fair. No, I do think We'll talk about this after. Let's wrap this up.
Take our answer off the air. So before we get to the Spice Rack, you can visit us at facebook.com/Tremblin' Thoughtsies, all spelled out. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at @T1Thoughtsies. Zach is at @A22EN. You can watch stream at twitch.tv/T1Thoughtsies, sponsored by Card Hoarder. You can see our YouTube videos at youtube.com/Tremblin' Thoughtsies, all spelled out. You can read my columns at blog.cardkingdom.com. You can become a member of the Thoughtsies Cabal at patreon.com/TurnOneThoughtsies, all spelled out. And you can see all of our content on TurnOneThoughtsies.com. The Spice Rack this week, in the spirit of beating humans, is the ultimate mirror breaker. And I did not know about this card until Zach told me about it. And we were talking about something else. And I was like, oh yeah. I was like, what's the mirror breaker in humans? And I thought about it for a minute and you were like, oh yeah, I already know what the mirror breaker is. It's Riders of Gavinny. And I was like, what now? Sure. So Riders of Gavinny is a 2WW for a 3/3 human knight with vigilance. Just cause I guess if you're going to pay 4 mana for a 3/3, it's got to have some upside. As Riders of Gavinny enters the battlefield, choose a creature type. Human creatures you control have protection from creatures of the chosen type. So, if you're in a human's mirror and you pick humans, all of your humans have protection from humans.
That's really good.
So it's like an exhibit thing, right? Like, I heard you like humans, so I protected your humans from humans so you can human while you human.
Yep.
And that is exactly what happens. I guarantee that if you stick this, which also, by the way, is not an ETB. Oh, no, it is. I'm sorry. It's enters the battlefield.
No, it's not. It's not an ETB. As it enters. It's a Meddling Mage clause.
Oh, yeah. There you go. So you can't even Torpor Orbit.
Well, the thing is, in the human's mirror, you just can't do anything about the card. It's like your answer would be Reflector Mage this, but like all of your creatures have protection from humans, so you can't target them with Reflector Mage. So it's like, there is no answer. And now all of your creatures have protection from all of their creatures. It's like all of your blocks go awesome. They can't block any of your stuff. It's just so outrageous. It's just not beatable.
Yeah. So if you're ever in a human's mirror, maybe put 2 Riders of Gavinny in your sideboard. Like if you're going to a big event, I think it's not unreasonable to put 2 of these in your sideboard.
Yeah, no, I mean, you probably want it. That being said, a lot of the decks are playing Phantasmal Image now, so like you play your Riders of Gavinny, they're probably going to copy it with theirs. So like maybe the next level is the gut shot, so you can gut shot their Riders of Gavinny and blow them out with a big block after an attack or something. I don't know. That's a thing. Dismember also is pretty important if this card's seeing play, but it is something to think about because this is a stone cold haymaker in the human's mirror.
Yeah, actually, you know, I don't hate gut shot right now.
No, gut shot's great.
Kind of an interesting little thing. I do love the,
like, I'm gonna throw,
like,
it up,
kill your Noble Hierarch like on the draw.
Oh yeah,
is so good.
Like, I'm gonna throw it out there, there's a 50% chance my sideboard has 2 gutshots this weekend. Just saying.
All right, I like it. I'm in. So that is what we have for this week. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch up with you next time.
See you guys.